KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we talk with organizer and author Jane McAlevey about the modern labor movement. McAlevey says unions have faltered and must change to better meet the needs of America's working class. In her latest book titled No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, McAlevey makes the case for more unions to roll up their sleeves and get back to doing the hard work of true grassroots organizing. Join us after this news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Union membership has decreased dramatically from about one-third of all workers 50 years ago to about 1 in 10 American workers today. Jane McAlevey says the problem is in part that unions have strayed from grassroots organizing in favor of mobilizing. The Bay Area-based labor activist tackles the question of what to do about unions' decline and how to tap into the disruptive power of America's working class in her latest book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Jane McAlevey also recently completed a postdoc at the Harvard Law School, and she's currently writing her third book, Striking Back. She consults to dozens of unions and worker rights groups in the U.S. and internationally. And welcome to Forum, Jane McAlevey.
Good morning. It is terrific to be here. Thank you.
I think we need to start with defining what organizing is. It's a term that's used a lot, but you really have a specific definition of it.
I do, and thanks for asking. It's pretty much the whole focus of the book, right, of my latest book, is trying to clarify that there are sort of different approaches to strategy in the U.S. And this doesn't apply just, by the way, to union organizing at all. This applies across the environmental movement, whether we're doing gender-based organizing, anti-racism organizing, whatever the form of work we're doing is. What I'm arguing in my new book is that my experience in the last 20 years is that there's a lot of confusion between three types of work: advocacy, mobilizing, and organizing. And so what's happened is you'll hear, you know, organizing has become a throwaway word, a bit like democracy. It's hard to actually, like, people say democracy and freedom. Okay, well, what do those words actually mean, right? Because everyone uses them. The right uses them, the left uses them, you know. So people say, I'm doing organizing. And the question is, well, what does that really mean? So I try to unpack that in my new book. And for me, organizing means fundamentally that in the case of a union organizing campaign or a union, that the power of decision making rests in the hands of the workers themselves, that the theory of power is one that the majority of workers themselves in a democratic fashion have the right to make decisions, that they're seen as the central actors in whatever the campaign is, whether it's a campaign for a contract, whether it's a campaign to form a union. By the way, earlier in the week, the cafeteria workers who work in Menlo Park at the Facebook campus just voted to form a union. That's a tremendous example of, like, workers having agency and making a decision to try and better their lives. So, so to me, organizing is a theory that says it's a grassroots-based theory. It's really a bottom-up theory. And if it's the case of a union or a women's rights group or an environmental organization like Sierra Club, et cetera, it means that the ordinary folks in the organization have the right to make the decisions about what's happening.
So how is that different from mobilizing?
Yeah, so mobilizing. And what I really talk about in the book is that there's been a 45-year – you talk about 50 years since the labor movement began to decline. And I'm sort of analyzing that period. I sort of start out in 1973. That's the point of analysis for me, is sort of 73 forward. And I look at how tactics and strategies have changed, not just in the labor movement, though that's my focus, but in the whole progressive movement in the U.S. And essentially, I argue that we used an organizing model in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and 60s through the heyday of the most positive changes in this country, where we broke down racial barriers, we created labor standards, we broke down gender barriers, right, from the civil rights movement to labor movement of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. We were doing what I call organizing. And that's what I was sort of analyzing during my PhD program recently in my doctoral work. What happens in the early 1970s in the U.S. is that we start to shift to what I call a staff-driven top-down model, where workers or the agents of change or ordinary people become secondary to lawyers, communications people, pollsters, and professional staff. And workers become more like props. Grassroots people become sort of like a prop in a larger campaign where the decision-making is really actually centered around some sort of professional staff who are, whether they're in a union or a women's group or an anti, you know, again, all the different forms of sort of what we think of as grassroots organizations in this country. The shift in 73, after we win everything, we win Medicare, voting rights, Medicaid, the right to retire, we've got labor law established, we have the clean air, clean water, right? We've sort of won these incredible achievements in American history. And the mistake that happened is that liberals sort of didn't really understand power or the power structure or how it works. And so people thought, great, we won all these laws. All we have to do now is hire a bunch of lawyers, hire a bunch of staff in Washington, D.C. or Sacramento in our state capitals and implement the laws. But if you read the Powell Doctrine or you looked at the crucial meetings that the organized corporate sort of conservative right-wing forces, in that exact period in 1973, there were two seminal meetings that happened that included a young Karl Rove, that included a young Dick Cheney. I mean, literally, you can place them in Cheyenne, Wyoming in a meeting. And they say, we got to roll back every one of the gains that the progressives in America just won. And they literally lay out a blueprint in 1973. And their blueprint is to begin to do grassroots organizing and to build a powerful base across the country. And liberals literally flip strategies and say, all we need to do is hire lawyers, implement our laws. And we shift into this model by the 1990s and the early 2000s, where strategy is now being determined by pollsters and something I call the consultant industrial complex.
So just to slow you down just a little bit, when you say strategy is being determined by pollsters, you mean essentially that staff are polling workers as opposed to directly engaging with them?
Yeah, definitely. It's in the labor movement, that's definitely what I mean. But I see it as a meta-narrative for what's wrong in this country and why we've unfortunately just elected this guy named Trump into office, right? There is a direct line between, I think, and I argue, between Trump's election and the sort of controlling power that the, again, I call it the consultant industrial complex, which is sort of like narrative frames, communications, pollsters, lawyers, the same forces that are at work in the Democratic Party that have taken the Democratic Party away from its base and towards a more corporate approach to their decision making, right? It's pro-corporate kind of party these days. That's why we had the Bernie Sanders fight back. That same group of professional consultants at works with America's unions and began to persuade America's unions that what they should do is actually stop spending all their time actually talking to rank and file workers and shift to we can just poll and get workers' opinions. Now, that is a huge failure. It's the number of people who vote in this country who turn out in regular U.S. elections. You can literally see the dropping off happening during the same period that I'm analyzing. If my basic argument is, if you talk to ordinary people in this country, the vast majority of them agree that, the President of the United States is, you know, not too far off of Scaramucci in terms of the comments he made last night, right? And most workers, certainly, which is who I spent my adult life talking to, most American workers, ordinary people in this country, want decent pay. They want the right to have a union. They want paid family leave. They want sick leave. They want the most basic things that every single other American really wants. And when we remove them from playing a central role, from being the key people in their own campaigns and the key people leading their own organizations, we result in this profound disconnect where yes, staff are sort of running and making decisions in organizations. Disconnected professional staff are running the Democratic Party. And ordinary grassroots folks are just sort of left out there having no meaningful say in decision making.
I think in the labor movement, your example of what you describe as a corporate campaign is a really illustrative example of this. Can you describe what a corporate campaign is?
Sure. A corporate campaign essentially is what we call an air war, right? There's sort of the ground war and there's an air war. And all of this terminology, which is maybe strange to listeners, is also very normal in the sort of Democratic Party or Republican Party or sort of campaign. So, but the ground war essentially means that you're engaging troops on the ground, right? And the air war is what we call a top-down corporate campaign, which means you are trying to eliminate the tax subsidies that a corporation might get from a state or federal body because actually the secret of this country is that corporations get incredible amount of tax subsidies. All kinds of corporations are being subsidized by you and I and every listener to the show and many more. And it means that you're doing things like brand damage and you're creating websites to attack the brand of the company, which, by the way, is what Naomi Klein says we should be doing to all Trump properties. And I want to agree with that. That's a good use of a corporate campaign. But what the corporate campaigns evolved to in the last 25 years in the U.S. union movement, which is something I'm very critical of as an organizer, is that, again, they took us away from engaging ordinary workers in the workplace. And they took us away from having conversations with millions and millions of workers about what they want. But I want to shift this for one second just to say that the real crisis about what happened to America's unions, because there's such a false narrative out there about this, is that there was a systematic attack on the unions that began back in that 1973 period.
Yes.
Right? So, like, I want to come back to that because I think it's so important. Today, what we hear a lot about is staggering income inequality. Like, there's this crisis of staggering income inequality in America. And part of what I write about in my new book is that we have a staggering income inequality because we have a staggering power inequality, meaning the working class in this country, which means the middle class also, right? We've sort of renamed the working class the middle class. That's part of what the pollsters did. But ordinary workers, right? That's the sort of 90% of us who don't own giant corporations, et cetera. We are structurally so much weaker because of the attack and destruction of America's unions. I argue we're not going to fix income inequality until we restore unions in this country in a serious way. Unions actually structurally contend against very powerful corporate forces day to day in the workplace. And I can give you an example. I spent most of last year living in Philadelphia, and I was helping to run what became, we think, the largest successful new organizing campaign in the country. And I was working with thousands of registered nurses who were fighting to form unions for the first time ever in hospitals. Hospitals in this country, and we're in a healthcare debate right now, and this is a sub part of it. Hospitals have gone from being what we think of as sort of a nonprofit. You know, you think of a hospital, you think it's supposed to be doing good. Hospitals have become this massive corporate for-profit private venture. So what you're seeing across the country, and certainly in California, but also all across the country, is that healthcare workers, for example, starting with nurses, are desperately trying to form unions because as the market-driven system comes into the healthcare system, it's been cutting staff, asking nurses to do way too much for way too little. What's being sacrificed is not just the mental health and the ability of registered nurses in this country or any hospital worker, but what's also being sacrificed is patient care. Now, why is that happening? That's happening because healthcare is traditionally not a unionized sector. So I'm looking at a future right now where I'm working with thousands of workers who are voting yes to form unions and who are actually The number one issue in the union negotiations is about staffing. So who's the number one beneficiary of that? Patients, families, and ordinary Americans.
We're talking with Jane McAlevey. She's a Bay Area-based labor activist and author. We're talking about the challenges facing the labor movement, also its recent missteps, and how it can better work with America's working class. You're really putting out two things here. You're talking about the union and how the union has adopted tactics that have created essentially made them out of touch with everyday workers. But at the same time, you're also talking about the incredible structural forces that are working against unions at the same time. So how are we supposed to manage that? How are people who want to, you know, basically roll up their sleeves and tap into the power of ordinary people, how are they to contend with that?
Well, I think if you look at what just happened at the Facebook campus and you saw 500 workers who work for – this is an interesting part of the dynamic. You just saw 500 workers actually have success unionizing in the cafeterias. You know, essentially low-wage workers on a good day, they're making $31,000 a year. Try and survive in Palo Alto on $31,000 a year, right? So they just voted to form a union. That, to me, is an example of why when people say that the labor movement is, you know, a thing of the past, I say you're completely crazy because there are workers winning unionization efforts every week in this country. Now, they're really hard, right? That massive structural power that's against America's workers and against America's unions is really intense. For people who have never experienced what it means to try and, you know, form a union as an ordinary worker, you will quickly come up against the forces of Steve Bannon, Breitbart News. I mean, I like to say that forces like Steve Bannon and Breitbart News got their start practicing in the American workplace, right? When you are trying to form a union, like the workers at Nissan right now in Mississippi, when you are actually trying to form a union as an ordinary worker, it is really hard. There's a campaign that is so aggressive, it makes sort of the Trump campaign and the Breitbart forces look gentle and soft compared to what workers go up against when they try and form a union. So I think several things are true. One is workers are doing it, right? I just worked with 7 hospitals worth of nurses in the state of Pennsylvania who all voted yes and formed unions, despite incredibly stiff odds, despite an anti-democratic campaign, despite disinformation, despite sort of vicious tactics by the employers who hire these professional union busters who sound a lot like Scaramucci on an average day. So I think what ordinary people can do is, one, ordinary folks need to support unions. There's a lot of ambivalence among liberals in this country about, do we still need unions going forward? Aren't unions a thing of the past? We hear that a lot,
right? Where do you think that comes from?
One, I think it comes from a very constructed narrative on the part of the business elite in this country. So it's a constructed narrative, and it's been going on for 40 years. And now the constructive narrative is the attack used to be on auto workers. The attack used to be on steel workers. The attack used to be that they we're making too much money in this country. No auto worker in America ever made too much money except for the top CEOs and management who still make too much money. What they achieved was a middle-class life. But because they had actually done such successful redistribution of power, they actually came under attack by seriously anti-worker forces in this country. And that same force of people has now turned their guns on what we call the public sector unions, on teachers, on public service workers, and it's a constructed narrative.
What about when, say, local governments say, gosh, you know, the union's demands are too much on our budget when we're trying to provide so many other services?
Yeah, the answer to that is we need to tax the super wealthy, the 1%, and corporations. The taxes on corporations starting in the Ronald Reagan years went down decisively. And if I'm hoping that the Trump forces have as little success when they start to move on taxes as they just had on trying to take away Americans' health care plans. That'd be a good thing if that happens. But they're about to start going after, right, a tax debate in Congress. So when local governments say, wow, the unions are demanding too much, I think, one, there's massive disinformation about what the average public service worker earns. They don't earn very much at all in this country. Their pensions are certainly not outrageous. Many of them don't get Social Security. That's an unknown fact on the part of many Americans. And the simple answer is, and we've seen it, and California is a perfect case study of it, right? When we passed in 2012 the ballot initiative to put a teeny tax on the super wealthy in the state of California, we literally rebalanced the state's budget in one single ballot initiative. And certainly we didn't see an outflux of super wealthy people leaving California. If anything, they're all over the Bay Area, right? People of color being displaced. We have black people leaving Oakland in droves. They can't afford to live here. So I think when a local government or a state government or even the federal government says, we don't have enough money to pay our workers, ordinary people need to stop and think really hard about why is that? What is it about the reduction of corporate taxes has led to the kind of austerity that we're facing right now that's being blamed on low-income and middle-income ordinary workers?
Do you think that some of the – here, especially locally, there were some pretty high-profile turf wars between, for example, SEIU and United Health Workers and the National Union of Healthcare Workers, I think I remember. That was that gained a lot of attention here in the sense of infighting, right, among unions also suggested to some that this was that unions, you know, couldn't keep their own houses in order kind of thing.
What's interesting is that the way that we talk about disputes inside the labor movement in the media is really different than the way we talk about disputes inside of corporations or Uber or something like that. Or sort of the scandal of priests in the Catholic Church. Or there's a sort of fascinating dynamic in the media, I think, where there is sort of not parallel construction, meaning we love to talk about failure and controversy and scandal inside of America's unions, but we talk far less about scandal, controversy, and corruption in America's corporations. We haven't even put a banker in jail yet in this country, and they literally sank the economy in 2008, right? So, yes, there was big drama. I'm very familiar with it.
Charlie has a question related to it. He says, ask Jane to explain why, as a member of the Service Employees International Union Executive Board in 2008-09, she supported putting United Healthcare Workers in in trusteeship a horrible decision?
Oh, I didn't support that. And that's, I mean, that's a kind of almost strange insider baseball. But I didn't actually support that decision. I was always aligned with the forces in California in the internal union dispute in SEIU. But that's, again, that's...
Well, I'm glad you were able to clarify that.
Clearly,
there are a lot of external forces and a lot of internal forces in the union that can improve the situation for workers. And that's really what you're trying to get at in your book, is what unions can actually control, because there is a lot going on right now that are going to be working against them, including things like automation, for example, that could take jobs, working class jobs away, or, you know, the gig economy. You brought up Uber a couple of times, right?
Oh, yeah. But actually, I want to get back to a more fundamental point. What's happening in this country right now is that our democracy is in tatters. And I'm saying there's a direct relationship between the attack on workers and unions inside the workplace in this country and sort of the attack on the broader working class. So the kind of campaigns that people are more familiar with right now in our country, where that you better understand, is sort of like, we understand that 97%, for example, 97% of scientists in this country actually agree that there's something called a climate crisis, right? We had the Larsen C shelf just fell off, for goodness sake. But the climate deniers are out there running this incredible fear and doubt campaign. So that's what workers deal with every time they try and form a union in this country, is that level of professional craziness. And I think we're at the point right now where there is a fundamental crisis. We have Trump in power. We have an attack on democracy by the Trump forces. And partly, the best education that the American working class in this country traditionally got was because they had unions in great numbers. And their unions helped form a mediating education about what was going on in the world. And we've attacked the unions. It was initially self-serving, I think, for the sort of the corporate elite to attack America's unions, try and have even greater profit. And what we're seeing now, 45 years later, is that our entire democracy is beginning to fall apart. And there is actually a throughput relationship between when you make it so that people have no power, no one's getting into the polls, no one's coming out to vote, no one understands what's going on in this country because we have a crazy Breitbart media spin taking place. The best thing we could do in this country to sort of salvage our democracy at this point is, one, to rebuild the union movement. That's the best way back to ending the kind of grotesque income inequality we have in the United States. And a bunch of us are still winning big union campaigns.
Because why? So just, I mean, you're painting this picture, but also just take that a step further. What is it about the power of middle class, working class, ordinary, whatever term you want to use, but the 90%, right? What is it about that power that can, you know, fix democracy, essentially?
Well, for one thing, when we had robust unions, we had a slightly saner country, just to make a line to what the health of our democracy, right? It was on the back of the trade union movement that we passed Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and every other major forward-moving piece of legislation that ever hit the United States in the last 150 years, came off the back of a strong trade union movement. So the only way we're going to get that kind of – the only way we're going to rationalize and have forward progress in this country again is when we actually reestablish powerful institutions like unions that can contend with super powerful corporate forces.
We're talking with union activist and author Jane McAlevey. Her latest book is No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. We'll come back after the break with your questions and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with labor organizer, author, scholar Jane McAlevey about the challenges facing the labor movement, what she sees as changes it needs to make to be able to regain its power and better empower America's working class. And we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the state of the labor movement? Do you feel unions are still relevant today? Do you belong to one? Have you experienced some of the things McAlevey is describing, whether they are positive or things that you wish they would do differently? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. You can post them on Facebook. You can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Stephen writes, I'm a union supporter. However, there's a distinction between public and private unions. In the public sector, there is a danger when unions achieve too much political power and are able to influence legislatures to benefit them at the expense of the general public. This causes a backlash against all unions. Could Ms. McAlevey address that distinction and that danger?
Yeah, sure. I think a couple of things. One is, unions are, to me, unions are one of the most interesting possible places to spend my adult life working. One, because I'm the daughter of trade unionists and I come from a union family, but because I think that unions are essentially made up of ordinary people. So if he's a member of a union, for sake of argument, I always say to people, if they say to me that they don't like their union, the first thing I say is run for office inside your union, right? It's actually a great experiment and it's a great base for sort of running for office later in life, because sometimes elections can be quite contentious. But I have to say the one thing is I don't believe that there are many examples in this country of unions having either A, too much power, not in my lifetime, or B, having anywhere near the power of the Koch brothers, the business roundtable, and the corporate capital elite of this country. So I think that until we bring corporate taxes back to the 35% rate that they were at under Ronald Reagan, which would literally take all of our budget, we could just eliminate state and local budget deficits if we simply raise taxes back to the Ronald Reagan years when it comes to what they're taxed at. So I actually think drawing a distinction between private sector unions and public sector unions is quite dangerous. I actually think drawing a distinction between the private sector and the public sector is a false narrative in the American economy. And I think it's used strategically by corporate forces and super right-wing forces as a way to mobilize people's opinions against public sector unions, sort of similar to the comment that the person who wrote in just made. So here's what I mean by this. There is really no pure private sector in this country. The so-called private sector, whether we're talking about the Silicon Valley corporations that dominate in this region or the auto plants or any other corporate sector in this country, Walmart, they are being massively subsidized by American taxpayers every single day. So to call them the private sector, I think, is a convenient fiction. It's like a narrative, because the private sector gets, we call it the good thing. It's the market thing. It's more pure. And the public sector in this country, for hundreds of years, we sort of demonized the concept of government, right? It's certainly today's daily narrative. It was the Trump narrative in the campaign, and it's the Breitbart narrative. So there is no pure public sector in our economy, and there is no pure private sector in our economy. And I argue in the book that we need to stop even saying private sector and public sector. There's capitalism. There's an American economic system called capitalism. And right now, the power imbalance is so skewed against working class and middle class people in this country, it's sort of terrifying. And so that's why I think people have to, any time they think or they listen to the idea that unions are getting too powerful in any sector, they need to, I'm asking them to just stop and really look at who controls decision-making in Sacramento, who really controls decision-making in Washington, D.C., and in most of this country. And it is overwhelmingly corporations.
And on the ground level, you also talk about looking at the power structure and understanding the power structure that you just described if you work as an organizer. I think that's something that you've also brought up has been lacking among organizers as well.
Yeah, I think in the book I talk a lot about what is power structure analysis, how do we understand power, and that's part of why I take us back to 1973. And I'm trying to argue that the forces that were leading the progressive movement between the 1930s and the end of the civil rights period, right, the heyday of positive progressive change in this country came from the civil rights movement and the trade unions. Almost every law that the Trump forces are trying to repeal right now, starting with the most basic thing called the Voting Rights Act, right, empowering black people to vote in this country. All of that legislation came from an approach that was run by people who were doing real organizing and who understood how power worked far better than activists do today. So what you saw, like at the Women's March, for example, right?
Which you participated in.
Of course I participated in, absolutely, and had a great time doing so and brought lots of neighbors with me. And, you know, I love a good march and I love a good protest. But sometimes I fear that sort of the the Our Revolution folks coming out of the Sanders campaign, the indivisible forces, the sort of the activist forces that are growing up these days haven't spent enough time doing what organizers do, which is a social structural analysis of who's really in power around them. What's the potential power that we can bring to bear in a victory on our side? What power do the opponents have? And if you're doing serious organizing, I argue you can't get to really good strategy unless you really understand how to do what I call power structure analysis. And I spend a lot of time on that in the book. And that's why, and again, I don't want to discourage the person who wrote it, and I think it was Steve who made that earlier comment, but I really think that if you looked at the real power structure analysis of the state of California, certainly or Washington, D.C., but even very locally when I'm running a campaign, like in Philadelphia last year, we spent 2 months before heading into a multi-hospital campaign, we spent 2 months with four researchers doing nothing but really understanding who really ran Philadelphia. And it's never who we think it is until you really get into it. And you can't plot good strategy if you don't first understand power.
You echo some of the sentiments that Zeynep Tufekci has written about, though she's focused on how new technologies made it easier for people to pull off a big protest through Twitter, Facebook, and various other things, but that it made them vulnerable to failure ultimately because the big protests would happen before any real understanding of the power structures that needed to be addressed after the big demonstration, was built. Do you agree that in some ways the rise of new technologies has actually made it harder to do deep organizing for organizers?
Yeah, I completely agree with her analysis on that. I think you saw it, whether it was Egypt, frankly, right, or whether it's here. So you've got, now I want to give it a good example. I wrote a story in The Nation magazine just last week about the biggest nurses' strike in the history of Massachusetts. That was last week. Didn't get any national headlines. 1,200 women workers walked off the job in protest of huge staffing cuts going on in their hospital and an attack on their right to retire, on their pension. And part of what I wanted to say, but I didn't really say, but I've said in a few interviews, is like, where were the 175,000 women in Boston who marched for the Women's March when 1,200 women with a male employer trying to take their pension away? Because Trump's in power, so the bosses are all emboldened right now. Like, where were those 175,000 women? Why were they not out in Boston standing up with striking women workers, right? So the disconnect between, like, how people learn, part of why I think organizing matters so much and what I call base building and basic grassroots organizing at the fundamental level, which we get to do still in good union campaigns in this country, part of why it matters so much is because we don't really learn how democracy works or power works in American schools. Let's just be clear about that. So how people come to learn how democracy really works and how power really works is through experience. And when you're an organizer and you're working with thousands of workers and they are walking through a very difficult campaign where their employer is threatening to fire them just because they want to form a union, people begin to really understand power in a different way. And when they show up at a protest, like the 1,200 women who walked off the job at Tufts University Center last week, they know what they're going up against. They're going up against an incredibly powerful CEO and management system at a major medical center in a city where healthcare is the dominant industry. Those women workers are tough as nails, strong, smart. They understand what they have to do to get it done, and I'm predicting that they're going to win when they get back in negotiations.
Well, let's go to some of our calls. Doug in Oakland. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Jane. It's Doug Block with Teamsters Joint Council 7. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Good. Thanks for coming on this morning. And I want to thank you for mentioning the Facebook victory. You know, those cafeteria workers joined over 5,000 shuttle bus drivers and security officers who have joined the Teamsters and SEIU through Silicon Valley Rising at the high-tech companies. But I actually want to talk about when Trump got elected last November, many of us were starting to write the epitaph for organized labor in the United States. And for the Teamsters in Northern California, the ironic thing is we have seen workers coming to us in ways they never have before. And we've organized over 3,500 new members since that election. I think it's because workers are scared. But something which you talk about in your book, every worker, regardless of their language, their gender, their national origin, their ethnicity, understands there's power in numbers. So my question to you is, how do we actually take the organizing that's happening and get it to scale in this country?
Doug, thanks.
Yeah, thanks. A couple of things. One is, just to his point, like that people were writing the epitaph on American labor when Trump was winning, and they've been doing that for the last few years, right, in the media, certainly, policymakers, et cetera. What's interesting is, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, in the early 1930s, when we had the exact same percent of workers in this country in the private sector, what I call the so-called private sector in unions, which was 6%, essentially, we're down to 6% again today. The last time we had numbers this low was in 1933. And Wall Street Journal, I have these great headlines that I footnote in the book, where people had declared unions dead in this country in 1933. And what happened 2 years later? The biggest organizing growth in the history of the United States of America through what's called the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the CIO. So, a little less than 100 years ago, unions are declared dead. They go through the largest organizing wave ever. Why? Because income inequality was disgusting. It was staggering. It was horrible. The same way it is now, you've got Silicon Valley workers working in, you know, these elite corporations in this region living in their garages and living in their cars, right? That kind of staggering income inequality, it's going to go somewhere. We're either going to go to an authoritarian regime like fascism and Trump, or we're actually going to start to rebalance power and rebalance income in this country. So to Doug's point, you know, a lot of what I do in the book is, this is my second book, I should say. In my first book, I describe many of my own organizing campaigns. It was called Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, and that was the first one I wrote. This new book, No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age, is essentially my PhD dissertation. And what was really interesting for me was to go around the country, have the time to go around the country and look where else were people winning? Where were they actually forming unions against stiff odds in this country, just like they just did at Facebook and just like it sounds like the Teamsters are doing in Northern California, which is fantastic. And there are two things. One is, what's clear is there's a set of methods that those of us who win are still using that come from the 1930s. So those of us who are still using the methods from the 1930s, which starts with what I call real organizing, really trusting workers, really understanding that ordinary workers have great intelligence, really respecting the intelligence of ordinary people, really empowering them in the campaign, leads to actual victories. And it leads to the kind of first contracts that nurses just won in 7 hospitals in Philadelphia that I had the pleasure of helping them negotiate last year. So at the root of it, it's, do we trust the ordinary intelligence of ordinary people? Do we do an educational process to bring them into a union campaign and into their own contract campaigns that results in huge victories? And you know what happens in Philadelphia, as an example, and I'm sure it's happening with the Teamsters here, is that when workers are empowered, when they take control of their unions, when they win standard-setting contracts that are good for themselves, their family, and their communities, and their country, because they're helping end gross income inequality, what it actually does is it leads them to tell all their friends and coworkers that they should form a union too. So I argue we don't even need public relations. We just need good unions, because when workers do really well in a contract campaign like they did in Philadelphia, and then they move to a hospital that doesn't have a union and they have terrible conditions where patients are, you know, not getting treated as well, where they can't retire, where they're working with too few nurses, for example, on a shift, what happens is they ring up the union and go, hey, I got to form a union in this place because now I work in a non-union hospital and it's terrible here. And I used to work in a good union hospital. So that is exactly the way that I think we can grow the U.S. labor movement moving forward.
Well, this listener wants to know, isn't minimum wage just another form of our beloved union? Maybe they're referencing the minimum wage fight, the fight for 15.
Yeah, I'm not sure. But here's the challenge with that. I mean,
with the fight for 15.
Yeah. Well, just sort of the idea of the minimum wages. Essentially, what the fight for 15, what the minimum wage campaigns, the living wage campaigns, right? They have all these different names. But what the sort of policy based wage campaigns have been attempting to do is, one, also attack staggering income inequality. But frankly, what they're not doing is attacking the power inequality that I keep describing, right? Because workers need more power. When a worker wakes up and is dealt, you know, a $2 raise. A, it's a great thing for that person and their family. Maybe they get out of the garage or out of their, you know, out of living in their car and actually get to rent a little place. So good luck trying to do that in the Bay Area. But the difficulty is, even the fight for 15, do you know what a $15 an hour annual salary is? $31,200. All right, try and live in the Bay Area, anywhere in the Bay Area. I'm $31,200. It's nowhere near adequate. We need about 65,000, high 50s just to survive in the Bay Area. You look at the rents in this region. Forget about purchasing. I mean, forget about purchasing if you're an ordinary middle-class worker in this country. If you look at the rents in this region, what we're doing is also contributing to, frankly, the climate crisis, because you've got workers who are driving 2 hours each way, you know, in fossil fuel cars clogging up the roads because they have to drive 2 hours away to afford the rent. So The reason why unions, I think there's always been two there's long been two approaches to how do we raise base income in this country. One is something like a minimum wage, which has been left behind for $7 and change at the national level. You have to work two full-time jobs at minimum wage in this country just to get to about $31,000. So 15 is a great improvement. But we're talking about a little bit less poverty than just outright poverty. When you win a union and you have a democratic union and you fight for a contract, you can win way more than those kind of wages. You can get us to the kind of ordinary wages that make it so that people can take 2 weeks vacation and maybe spend a little time with their kids. That's all workers want.
Well, we've got a lot of calls and questions to get to. Andre in Sacramento. Hi, Andre.
Hey, how's it going? Thank you so much for taking my call. And Jane, thanks for all the information about the unions. So I'm actually agree with you 100%, especially about moving out of the Bay Area. I'm actually got displaced myself recently after living in the Bay Area for 40 years. It was a pretty traumatic experience where my rent was raised about $800 in one thing. So I agree with that. And also, I just want to let you know that as far as the unions overall, I'm actually agree pretty much everything with what you're saying as far as the unions. Now, what I'm concerned about is this. So actually, I'm actually a union supporter and somebody that actually believes in the cause of the union. However, my role, actually, I've worked in a hospital setting with a union where actually it was in management. And so as a manager, I dealt with the direct conflict with some of these nurses and the unions. And one of the issues that I found that was very difficult is really dealing with difficult, employees. And so you mentioned that when Philadelphia, how the staffing was the main concern. You said staffing is kind of the main concern of the nurses. Well, I really feel there's a conflict there because when there is a difficult person in the staff, you actually can't get rid of them. And because of the way the union is structured, and as a manager, it's very difficult to deal with that. It'll take years. And so that's really where my conflict is. How do you deal with that situation where the unions really set up a structure that actually prevents you from dealing with it, which actually will get to the actual problem the nurses have in the first place?
Andre, thanks.
Yeah. A couple of things. One, thanks for the call, Andre. And I appreciate all of your comments. But I think two things are true. I have spent a lot of time in my life trying to explain that simply having a union contract does not mean in any way, shape, or form that you cannot get rid of a quote-unquote a bad worker if there is one. So it's simply a myth. Not speaking to Andre, because he obviously has some nuance about this, but in general, you hear a lot, oh, all unions do is defend bad workers. You can't fire workers. Managers just need to study union contracts better and actually follow the basic rules in them. Every union contract I've ever negotiated, and I've negotiated many union contracts, have a termination procedure, have a dispute resolution clause. And so that's just one general concept, is that I find that managers often just don't pay any attention to the union contract because they act like it's a suggestion box in general, the union, as opposed to something that has some structural power in the workplace. But also they just don't spend any time following the rules of the contract. And if they do, there's usually, you write them up, you follow a procedure, you have 15 days, you have agreement, eventually. And it doesn't take long, quite frankly. From our view, it doesn't take long at all.
Well, let me again,
to get rid of a worker. But
thank Andre for that call. And I just, we only have about 10 minutes left, and we have been getting a lot of comments and calls. And I do just want to read a few just to give you a feel. Dylan writes, as a former union member and a Senate intern, I'm turned off to today's unions. They own some of the most expensive real estate in the world and ignore their actual members. They are now large corporate interests. Eric, on the other hand, writes, as a teacher, I feel our unions are often maligned, but they can serve as the front lines of holding school districts accountable to their obligations to provide resources to students. It can prevent, quote, strategic vacancies in looted communities from being a money-saving tactic while the district talks about equity. And Pamela tweets, unions are the only institution standing between us and total corporate control. Let me hear next from David. Hi, David in San Francisco.
Hey, I'm totally impressed by who you are and how you're presenting yourself and where you are. I'm just first of all, a little background. I was standing in line going to see Bernie's last speech out in Oakland, and the nurses have a bus, and they came by on their bus, and I felt that solidarity so strong just by them coming by. But what I want to ask you is how you can be found. You've written two books now. You want to get the word out. And I'd like to find a way in which maybe your class analysis, you could put it out there. Some way we could get together with you. Some way you could step forward as a human being, who you are in this movement. It's called resistance with Trump and all it meant. So tell us, sister, how do we find you?
All right, David.
Thank you so much.
Diamond Dave.
Yeah, I am. I have a website, janemcleavy.com. I'm easily findable there. And I have spent the last few years writing two books because I think there are a lot of stories to tell about how American workers can still win. And I'm not writing off unions in this country because I just went through an experience with thousands of nurses again in Philadelphia who just right-sized in a good way, going back to Andre's point, which I think I short-shifted at the end. I want to say one thing about that, and it relates to the three comments that you read, too. Democratic unions, good unions, the best unions, are really led by, like, workers who are considered to be the best workers. And just to his point, like, when a union is democratic and people really participate in big numbers, they will elect the workers they respect the most. And I've never been in a situation in a union where a good worker, in this case a good nurse, wants to leave someone who's considered a not very competent nurse around for very long. In fact, they want to get rid of them faster than management, right? Because when you have to pick up patient care from the night shift to the day shift and you're passing off report on a patient, it's the workers who know before management whether or not someone's doing a good job. And workers want to do a good job in this country. So, and I appreciate that comment about the teachers. I mean, I do think teachers and teachers unions are the only thing that are holding us back from, Christian education, Betsy DeVos style.
But that said, for anyone who reads your book, you certainly don't give unions a pass book. You're actually critiquing union functions. Rich in San Jose. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a licensed general contractor, and I've been one for 20 years now. And if it wasn't for unions, and this is what people seem to forget, if it wasn't for unions, I wouldn't be able to do what I do for a living. I wouldn't be able to charge what I charge for a living, and I would be able to be an independent businessman. People seem to lose the fact that they're the people who put themselves out on the line so that all wages could go up together as one. Now, me personally, I've never been a union person, but I have respect for the union for what it's been able to do for our country. And when you lose sight of the important fact that if you don't get together and ask for what you want, you'll never get what you need.
Well, Rich, thanks for making that point. I want to read Ben's comment to you just kind of off of that, which is he says, what are the best ways to fight the current demonization of unions? Ideas of mob-infiltrated unions, union thugs, and lazy union workers are so prevalent. Even people in unions propagate this nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. I think the best way is the situation I'm describing in Boston where 1,200 women workers just walked off the job and, like, where were the indivisible forces? Where were the Our Revolution people? Where were all the people who were marching, against Trump a few months back? Like, when you see that workers are having struggle, when you read in the headlines that a tough contract negotiations are coming up, pay attention to what's happening around you locally and get out there and support trade unions because it's really crucial. I think write letters to your – I want that basic stuff about, like, what Ben just called in about, and I want to thank Rich for that comment. He's a kind of an employer that there aren't that many of in my experience. I'm usually dealing with employers who are viciously anti-union. I've worked with some employers who are not viciously anti-union during contract negotiations, and they understand the basic balance of power and that their workers should have some basic rights to a decent income and a decent retirement. So I think to Ben's point, Ben should be calling into every show all the time, every day, writing letters, letting his friends know. And we have to challenge the narrative. We really do. Go ahead.
Here's one narrative from Andrew. He says, sadly, I think CalPERS and the unions who wrote the law signed in 1999 poisoned Californians' views of unions a long time ago. Double dipping, overtime spiking, and refusing to redo past mistakes make California unions look greedy. I'm under 35 years old, and I will never be pro-union as long as California budgets are strangled by past union mistakes.
California budgets are strangled by corporations not paying enough money in this state.
Rob writes, I don't see how unions can save our country. What about the swamp? How do we get rid of this political campaign lobbying ecosystem that the elite American oligarchs control?
The only way to challenge the coming oligarchy, I mean, we basically just elected an oligarch, which is terrifying. I partly argue in the book that the oligarch just got elected, that Trump just got elected, and the swamp is the swamp because of the disproportionate power that working class people have in this country, right? We had a, when we were, think, go back to the 1960s. Go back to the time in this country when what Congress was doing was passing Social Security so that older people had the right to retire without eating cat food under bridges, when our Congress was approving the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, when our Congress was making gains for women workers in the economy, that was all the result of when we actually had strong unions in this country.
Well, I think we can squeeze in one more call from Michael in St. Louis. Hi, Michael. Hi, Michael. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah. My grandfather was born in 1899, and he became the general treasurer of the iron workers. And he moved from Brooklyn to St. Louis, and they moved the headquarters to St. Louis. And he used to tell me, you know, that the unions, they started the eight-hour workday, the pension system, safety on the job site. And Missouri just became a right-to-work state. And I tell my friends here about what unions did and the positive things they did for this country. And I think we all kind of lose sight of the history of the unions. And I'm happy to listen to your show where there's a pro-union person on explaining to people in Missouri over the internet the importance of unions.
Well, Michael, thanks for saying that. And I think it's true we forget things like child labor laws, workplace safety regulations, the eight-hour workday, the weekend. Those were all won by the unions. We just have a minute left, Jane McAlevey. If you could marshal the forces around one issue right now, what do you think the issue is that we need to tackle?
I mean, look, the historic issue that we have to tackle is income inequality, right? That is it. And partly that means that Americans need to stand up for a redistribution of wealth. And that happens when they stand up for building powerful organizations like unions that can actually challenge the dominant narrative of sort of like the quote-unquote free market, which is so not free in this country, the free market as being like a god in America. I want to go back to the most simple thing that caller, Michael, just said. Remember what the basic demand was of unions in the late 1800s? It was 8 hours to work, 8 hours to sleep, 8 hours for what you will. We have almost never gotten there, and we should fight for the 8 hours to work, 8 hours to sleep, and 8 hours for what you will.
Jane McAlevey, author of No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Her new book coming up is called Striking Back. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.